the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and again, Natasha Benjamin will be co-hosting. Hi, Natasha.
Hey, David.
Today, we're happy to be speaking with an old colleague, Bob Schaefelton of Homer, Alaska. Bob worked for 27 years as the Cook Inlet Keeper in South Central Alaska, protecting 180 miles of salt water, stretching from the Gulf of Alaska to Anchorage. Today, he runs a water taxi on Kachemak Bay and sits on the board of the Prince William Sound Advisory Council that was formed after the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. But before we get on to all that, here's the latest blue news you can use. What do you got, Natasha?
Scientists have found that whale songs actually include an alphabet, which is pretty interesting. I think if you listen to the sounds, specifically the sperm whales they were looking at, if you listen to the sounds, it's pretty obvious that this is not just sounds, but there's actual repetition. So let me play you a little clip here.
They're using Morse code.
Exactly. So it's pretty interesting. They're finally looking at these sounds in a different way and have found these repetitions and changes in tone and variation. And now using AI to try to decipher this whale language. So maybe this is an actual useful tool for AI.
Amazing. I suspect if we begin talking with the whales, one of the first things they'll ask is, what the heck have we been doing with their favorite currents? Because a new study suggests that surface to deep water Atlantic circulation, known as AMOC, or as I now call it, AMOC, soon could collapse due to melting Arctic ice and warming seas, which could lead to massive changes in our weather. Everything from a new ice age in Europe to another 3 to 4 feet of sea level rise along the Jersey shore. More proof that it's time to get off fossil fuel, and hopefully it's not too late if we take action now. And speaking of action and famous ocean activist, Bob, before we get into your incredible career, you can tell us about just your earliest connections with the ocean back in your youth in Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Thanks, David. Hi, Natasha. Appreciate being here. Well, when you give the news you can use, I grew up in New Jersey. So when I hear 3 to 4 feet of sea level rise in New Jersey, that gets my attention. I grew up on a barrier island, Upsecan Island in southern New Jersey. I think the highest point on that island was 13 feet. I was born there in 1964, so I spent my childhood and formative years in and around the ocean. You know, my early years, New York was dumping sludge in the deep canyons off of New Jersey. I can remember walking out in the water and you couldn't see your feet, and there wasn't a lot of marine life, and the fisheries were depressed. And I think around 1980, Congress passed the Ocean Dumping Act. And once that sludge dumping stopped, it was really transformative almost overnight. You could see the life come back. I could walk out in the ocean. I could see my feet. It was clear. We saw pelicans and dolphins and fish return. So that really had a major impact on me that we can make this change.
So how did that affect your life in terms of going from a youth seeing this in New Jersey to where you are today?
Well, it's hard when you think back, you know, when you're young, and especially where I grew up, you know, it was a great place to grow up. You know, it was always water. It was always ocean that was kind of guiding me. And you know, I went through the era where the medical waste was washing up, and it was really a unpleasant thing. But again, there was this transformative moment when they stopped using our oceans as dumping grounds. And so if I track my career and I look at the commonalities and all those things, it's always water. That was the thing, that central theme that connected all the different things that I did throughout my life.
Did you go to college to study on like the ocean, or was that something that came to you later on?
Well, I went to college studying biology and chemistry, and I did have that light bulb moment in my freshman year, and I took an ecology class, and it suddenly dawned on me like, oh, wow, everything's connected. So once you get that and you realize that everything is connected and we're just this blue marble floating in the cold, dark space, then you realize how fantastic the planet is and that it's worth trying to protect.
So what did that mean in terms of, you know, you graduate, you've got degrees in chemistry, and where'd you go from there?
Well, I came back and I was kicking around, but then I worked for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection looking at landfills. And when you look at landfills in New Jersey, it's quite an eye-opener. So, you know, these are historical dumping grounds that preceded our major environmental laws and, you know, some horrific contamination. You know, there was attempts then to modernize and standardize how we dispose of our waste. But it really opened my eyes. Among the other things I saw when I was there is that the lawyers were doing a lot of the important work. And so that got my interest in going to law school and much to the chagrin of my father, I think. But, you know, I did that and I decided that public interest law was the direction I wanted to go. And so I went out to Eugene, Oregon. And that's really where I got immersed in kind of environmental activism and recognizing that, you know, we've got to push pretty hard if we want to counter the forces that are chewing up the planet.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, now looking back on things, going from dumps in New Jersey to Alaska in one of the most beautifully epic spots that you're in now, and the work that you've accomplished over that time, you've come a long way. Will you tell us a little bit about what it's like going from Atlantic City to Homer, Alaska?
It's a big change. After law school, I went to upstate New York and I worked for a small firm called Atlantic States Legal Foundation and a gentleman named Sam Sage, who you might know. But Atlantic States Legal Foundation was really the preeminent kind of boutique litigation firm in the country. And so I did a fair amount of Clean Water Act litigation and also right to know litigation. And when Congress passed the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, there's requirements that simply said, why don't you just tell us what you're putting into our land, air, and water every year? And so those reports were mandatory. So we would go around and make sure everyone was providing that information. And again, the idea was that with better information, companies would feel pressed to reduce their toxic discharges and the community would have a better idea of what impacts there were to their families. But I think the question was, you know, how did I get up here? I was in upstate New York and, you know, I saw this job come up for Homer, Alaska. I had never thought about Alaska ever. Alaska was just some place up there and I really didn't have any connection to it. So I can recall coming up for the interview and it was cold. It was winter. And I just felt completely like I landed on some alien planet and I couldn't imagine landing in a better place. I feel incredibly lucky and it's the most beautiful place I could imagine working to protect.
Now, tell us how three oil companies helped establish the Cook Inlet Keeper.
After the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which of course, there was a couple of days of decent weather, they could have mounted a response, but all the response equipment was under snow. And then of course the weather blew up because it's winter in Alaska. And so that slick spread far and wide. And so Homer and Kachemak Bay and Lower Cook Inlet are in the spill affected region. So the people of Homer were very affected by that spill. So it wasn't long after that a group of people started looking at the oil industry in Cook Inlet. And in the 1950s, oil was discovered onshore in Cook Inlet in something called the Swanson River field. Shortly after that discovery, that development moved offshore. This is again before all the major environmental statutes. So it was really kind of a Wild West scenario. You know, these guys going out there with pipe and big rigs and drilling holes and putting in platforms. And it was kind of crazy, some of the conditions. I mean, Cook Inlet has radical tides. We've got the second highest tides in North America. So you can see a 30 plus foot tidal swing in a little over 6 hours. Working in those conditions when you've got huge sheets of pan ice and sub-zero temperatures. So the infrastructure that all exists today mostly went in back then in the 60s and 70s. So it's all deteriorating. And of course, they were grandfathered in a lot of ways when the Clean Water Act came in for their pollution discharges. So that was one of the things that I fought for many, many years to stop the industry from discharging billions of gallons of toxic effluent into beluga whale habitat, the beluga whales listed on the Endangered Species Act.
And you did some of the first water monitoring operations in Alaska.
We set up the first citizen-based water quality monitoring program in the state. It was very difficult at the time because I had probably $250,000 to go out and set up a monitoring program. And a lot of people wanted me to go out and, you know, take some samples and bust the bad guys. But as you know, our environment is so incredibly complex, but it's almost impossible to show cause and effect. It's almost impossible to show that this molecule of toxic discharge caused this effect on this resource. And it's like a needle in a haystack when you talk about the complexity of Cook Inlet, because you've got such massive volumes of water. I shied away from that idea of trying to rent a boat and go out and take heavy metal and hydrocarbon samples, just because I knew that if I came up with nothing, then the oil industry say, see, the Cook Inlet keeper says we have a clean bill of health and everything's fine. Instead, we pulled back. We brought in Mike Hers from the San Francisco Bay Keeper. We brought in Jill Payne from the Casco Bay Keeper Program in Maine, and they shared with us how to bring people into monitoring their own local waters. And we had a very successful program for, I think, 12 years. We got 5 years of baseline data on a variety of sites. And probably the most important part of that was just getting people to roll up their sleeves and get their hands wet.
A lot of that work around water quality and water monitoring has informed a lot of what's happened with looking at salmon populations. And some of those studies around climate change, I think, are really important, showing how the water is changing, and the climate change impacts on the salmon populations have a huge impact on those communities. And you're getting the citizens involved as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's a great point. You know, salmon, like all fish, are greatly affected by the temperature of the water that they live in. And I think one of the things I'm most proud of is a program that we did to look at the impacts of climate change on salmon. They're the scientist at Cook Inlet Keeper that I think is most responsible for that is Sue Mauger. And, you know, we pioneered the use of these tiny temperature data loggers that we would deploy in the major salmon streams around Cook Inlet. And we were able to chart the temperature rise in these streams and recognize some streams are glacially fed. And as long as that ice cube is still at the headwaters, and as long as that cold water is coming down, those streams are going to be okay for a while. But it's the non-glacial systems that present the real challenge. And, you know, there's so many impacts where I live on the Kenai Peninsula. These are streams on the road system, so they're very accessible. They're not glacially influenced. And so we're really seeing a lot of change in those systems and the need for building in more protections and to build in the resilience of these systems. And one of the things that we looked at and Sue looked at was the influence of groundwater, you know, this cold upwell, and we call them cold water stepping stones, because you've got these systems, these areas where you've got cold water that would allow salmon to take refuge and get up and down the water bodies. So, that's a very important point. And now it's gone statewide. I mean, I think it was such a strong model, and people recognize the importance of the temperature and salmon survivorship that, you know, they're looking more closely at it statewide.
So along with salmon and oil rigs, Cook Inlet has a resident population of beluga whales, and you got hundreds of thousands of acres set aside as a kind of protective zone for the belugas. That's back in 1999. How did that happen, and what's the status of these whales today?
Well, you know, if you look to the last glaciation of Alaska 10,000 more years ago, the state was covered by ice. And when that ice retreated, you had this population of beluga whales tucking into these nooks and crannies. So there's five stocks of beluga whale in Alaska, and one of them in Cook Inlet is really constrained. It's really cut off. And the estimates of the numbers, you know, back in the 80s, they estimated there was around 1,000 whales. But then you saw this demographic shift. You saw a lot of native people moving from the villages in Western Alaska. They brought with them their desire to hunt beluga whale. And it was very poorly regulated. So in the mid 90s, you had several years of large takes, you know, where 50, 60, 70, 80 whales were being taken a year, and that was just too much for that population. So there was a moratorium and a voluntary stand down on those takes. But by that time, the population had been really repressed and down to the zone where it is around now, around 350, 375 whales. And so the scientific consensus at the time was that once you stop that hunting, that you would see a rebound in the population. But we haven't seen that. And there's so many other stressors. Again, we've got the toxic oil discharges in that same area that's important beluga habitat. We've got our largest city discharging sewage. So the whale is really still teetering, I think, on the edge of extinction. But the last couple of years have shown a little bit of light, and that the decline isn't as steep as it had been.
I was once out with a local Florida guy who was also in the state Marine Patrol, what he thought of jet skis, and he sort of formed his hand into a gun and kind of swung it around. He says, they're not a problem. You just need to lead them a little more. So people aren't big fans of jet skis down in the Florida Keys. You actually got a ban on jet skis in Cook Inlet. What was that about?
Well, that was in Kachemak Bay. So, you know, there's a great story of Kachemak Bay. You know, in the 1970s, the state went ahead and leased Kachemak Bay for oil and gas. And when they did that, at the time, there was very rich shrimp and crab fisheries going on. And long story short, they brought in a drill rig that then had an accident and there was a spill. And the legislature passed a law and they bought back these oil leases from the oil industry. And in doing so, the next step was to create Kachemak Bay as a critical habitat area under state law. And so with that, we were able to move to create a ban on jet skis because we started to see an increase in that interest. But several years ago, we had a governor come in with an attitude that we should have motorized access everywhere. Everybody should have the right to use whatever vehicle they want to get anywhere. So they unilaterally rolled back that ban. It was a bogus effort. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we said, you know, Kachemak Bay is a, you know, it's a beautiful body of water. Today it's flat calm. It's just, it's amazing, but it's a big body of water and it's Alaska and it can get very dangerous. And so I told the commissioner of Fish and Game, I said, you know, when someone dies, this is going to be on your hands. And so lo and behold, last year we had a tour company that was taking people out beyond the critical habitat area for jet skis, and they got seaweed in their intakes, and these people ended up on an island with you know limited clothing and no signaling devices and no food and water, and it was a precarious position. That company, I learned today, just went belly up. They decided they weren't going to do this anymore, even though they invested millions of dollars and jet skis in this whole business. So
I remember taking a water taxi across to the state park, which of course in Alaska, state parks like hundreds of thousands of acres, and seeing a pelagic Jaeger on the way harassing other birds for their feed. What's it like day to day being out there?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, again, I grew up on the ocean. I love the ocean. And so being connected to it by running a water taxi is just a wonderful opportunity. Every day is different and the conditions are always different. And we're always seeing different things. We just, you know, in the past couple of days, there's been orcas. There was a stray walrus that came through that was on the rocks way out of its territory. There were some gray whales. There were some humpbacks, a lot of shorebirds. It's just a spectacular place, and there's still a lot of primary productivity going on here that drives this rich ecosystem.
So this is real wilderness that you're describing. You know, most of us down here in the lower 48 might have not experienced that, but at the same time, there's still the pressure from oil and gas industry, the coal industry, pollution. How has kind of what Alaska has done and what the Cook Inlet keepers have done to protect that? Like, how can that be? What lessons learned do you think you can share with some of the other communities that are trying to fight oil and gas and pollution and these large industries that are impacting us?
Well, you know, that's a good question because, you know, our entire system really is rigged to favor resource development. You know, if you look at the capitalist model, if you look at the way the railroads created this idea of split estate where you could own the surface, but you don't own the mineral rights under it. Those things are locked in, they're baked into this system that make it very hard to have permanent change unless you have a legislative body that's willing to step out there and say, hey, this stuff is too important and we're going to lock it up forever. A great example is the Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay is the richest red sockeye salmon fishery in the entire world. And it's just the most spectacular place you've ever seen in terms of, you know, big brown bears and amazing streams just teeming with wild salmon. And there was a proposal, you know, that we got involved in 2003 because there's a huge deposit of low grade gold and copper in this in the headwaters of this area. And so, those mineral rights are subsurface rights, and the state holds those supposedly in trust for current and future generations. But they lease them to this company that has waged a very aggressive and long-term fight. But fortunately, the conservation community recognized what was at stake here, and it's probably one of the biggest in monetary terms and people power terms fights that I've seen ever in our country over, and it became really a big litmus test. And it continues to this day because those leases, those underground mineral leases, have not been extinguished. And so as long as they're there, that threat lingers. And so what you need is our state government to say, hey, this is just too important. We're either going to buy back these leases or we're going to condemn them. We're going to take them and we're going to say, we're locking this place up for current and future generations because we want to sustain these wild salmon populations and the communities and the native cultures they support.
So when we were working to get $10 billion of blue funding into the Green New Deal, and we talk with Congressman Deb Haaland, who's now the first Indigenous Secretary of Interior. And I'm wondering how the Biden administration has impacted and also the role of Native Alaskans in kind of transforming what's going on up there. Obviously, the Biden administration permitted the Willow oil drilling in the north of Alaska. What's its impact elsewhere?
Well, we're seeing a large infusion of money coming in for green infrastructure, and that's good. Renewable energy, some of the Port and Harbor expansion. I sit on the Homer Port and Harbor Commission, and a lot of that money and a lot of our focus has been on electrification. And we're also seeing a very big emphasis on mariculture, on seaweed and shellfish farming, which I think was great. I just had the opportunity to be ran on the water taxi for a mariculture tour the other day, and we were looking at oyster farms, and then we went over and looked at a kelp farm that's coming up to speed. And I think there's just a lot of opportunity there, and I think the Biden administration has made a lot of that stuff more possible.
We just interviewed kelp farmers on the East Coast in New England, and a lot of the fishing community is transferring into this aquaculture, mariculture, as the lobster fishery is changing in New England. They're looking for new opportunities. Are you seeing that in Alaska as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, our fisheries in Alaska, you know, when I came in here, it was funny. My first brochure that I created was a colorful brochure. And in the back, I said, you know, we don't have to repeat the mistakes made elsewhere. You know, I was coming from New Jersey where, you know, we had these incredible barrier islands that had to be such rich cornucopias of food before the white settlers got here. And so the whole idea was that we can learn from those mistakes. And I recognized when I got up here, well, we're humans and we tend to repeat our mistakes. You know, Alaska has always held itself out to have this world-class management regime. You know, we're Alaska. We know how to manage our resources. Well, you know, in Cooking alone, I can point to, you know, a half dozen different declines. You know, our razor clams on the side of Cooking that have crashed. Our shrimp population's gone. Our king crab population's gone. You know, our herring are gone. And so now some of our really iconic fisheries like halibut and salmon are starting to feel these effects. And again, it's so complex with climate change and everything, but overfishing and poor regulation are certainly to play in that. And one of the biggest things that we're seeing up here too is just the indiscriminate trawl fisheries.
The big pollock fishery that's like the number one.
The big pollock fishery that just the bycatch is just enormous. It's really just clear cutting the oceans, and it's not just taking the biomass of the bycatch and discarding it, but it's also just raking all the habitat and the benthic environment there. And they're just it's a highly destructive but very lucrative fishery. With that profit comes a lot of political power.
Also, bycatch may include salmon, which is the huge fishery for Alaska, huge iconic.
Absolutely. These are long, long river systems where you have, you know, dozens and dozens of native villages that rely on salmon for their subsistence culture and for their survival. And then you're seeing these closures where these native communities are unable to fish, which has been in their culture for thousands of years, and it literally feeds their families through the winter. So that political power that comes from the profit that comes from the pollock fishery is enormous.
And I know tourism is also a big part of job creation in Homer. So what would you say in terms of who should come to Homer and what water taxis should they look for?
Well, there's a lot of water taxis. I'm biased. Mako's Water Taxi is the one I work for, and it's the oldest and most established in the city. But, you know, tourism is that double-edged sword, right? I mean, you know, there's nobody that will stand up and say, okay, we've had enough tourism. Let's stop here, because that's the way our entire system is rigged around capitalism. You know, nobody's willing to say we've grown enough. Let's stop now. You know, every year there's more mouths to feed. There's small businesses. There's more Airbnbs and people coming in. But, you know, I like to tell the story. When I was with Cooking Like Cooper, I would go to Chamber of Commerce and I'd say, I'll give anybody in this crowd $10,000 right now if you can name one thing that grows forever. And nobody could answer the question because there is no thing. So how could we have an economic model that's premised on this fallacy that you can grow forever? It's complete fiction. So it's a giant pyramid scheme and we're enriching everyone at the top. But when it comes down to the ground here in Homer, you can see the stresses and strains on our limited infrastructure when you've got, you know, thousands of people flooding into our community and flooding under the Homer, spitting into our Homer every day.
So keep the cruise ships out and limit the numbers coming in.
Yeah, well, the cruise ship industry is a for-profit industry, and they're very good at what they do, and they understand how to squeeze small communities and small businesses so they can wring out as much profit as they can. And Homer has been cautious, and we have small cruise ships that come in, you know, nothing over really 2,500 people. But even then, our infrastructure gets fairly taxed when that big slug of people comes into town. So we don't see the industrial-level tourism that you see in Southeast or Seward. You know, places like Juneau, where 10,000 people are getting off a boat and all going to the bathroom at the same time.
It's amazing challenges everywhere.
But in the meantime, it was amazing speaking with you, getting a little glimpse of the Alaska wilderness. Want to thank you, Bob Shavelson, formerly with the Cook Inlet Keeper, for speaking with David and I today on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast.
Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky, there you are. Good boy, Sparky.